As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
So on the one hand, it is just a transfer of operational control, which is in the broader history, which, as you alluded to, I get into in some of my recent pieces. This is really a continuation of a long-term trend where South Korea has gradually taken on much more of the burden relative to their larger U.S. ally in an alliance and combined alliance command architecture. So this would be really just the fruition of what's been a longer-term process and has been alliance policy for now two decades. It's been what we've moved towards as an alliance. It would be more fundamental, though, insofar as, again, referencing that same broad history, when you look at South Korea's existence as a nation state, as a juridical entity established in 1948, it's only possessed the operational control of its own military for 1 year of that national existence.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel United States Army, retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye, Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 50, ROK-US Alliance, the Near Future, a dialogue with Dr. Clint Work. And this conversation could not be more timely. Just this morning in Washington, President Trump and President Lee Jae-myung, they concluded their first summit. While the full details are still emerging, one thing is clear. The future of the alliance, and especially the question of strategic flexibility, was on the agenda. For more than seven decades, the ROK-US alliance has been the anchor of peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. But today, it stands at a historic inflection point. I've been part of these debates for more than 20 years, dating back to my time as policy branch chief at U.S. Forces Korea. Back then, we knew the alliance needed to evolve. We called the effort the Future of the Alliance Initiative, or FOTA. It was a sweeping package of reforms, of force relocation, mission transfer, OPCON transfer, and the introduction of what became known as strategic flexibility. That concept is often misunderstood. Strategic flexibility is not a plan for withdrawal. It is resilience by design. It means distributed basing, rotational enablers, and interoperable command and control. The aim is to keep deterrence against North Korea fully intact while enabling U.S. forces in Korea to support wider regional contingencies. In short, it's about recalibrating for tougher threats, not retreating from the peninsula. Now, this brings us to OPCON transfer. Too often, it's treated as a technical milestone, but in reality, it's the central pathway to alliance modernization. The logic is straightforward. As Korea assumes the lead in deterring the DPRK, the United States gains flexibility to focus on other priorities in the Indo-Pacific. That division of labor strengthens both deterrence on the peninsula and resilience across the region. Taken together, these changes point to a broader transformation. The old alliance model of U.S.-led, peninsula-focused, threat-specific is no longer sufficient. OPCON transfer is not the end of an old process, but the beginning of a new one, a test of readiness, a shift from dependence to autonomy, and an opportunity to evolve the alliance into a regional security enabler. To help us unpack these critical issues, I'm joined today by Dr. Clint Work, a research fellow at the National Defense University's Institute for National Strategic Studies. He's a leading expert on U.S. security policy in Northeast Asia and a widely published analyst on the ROK-US Alliance and the Indo-Pacific strategy. Clint Work, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you for having me, James. It's good to be here.
Oh, absolutely glad to have you. As we begin, Clint, I wonder if you'll just tell us your story. How did you become an expert in this area of study?
Sure. Well, it was especially, this might be helpful for many students who might be watching, not sure what they're going to do next. It was not at all linear. This is not what I had intended to do. I didn't, as an undergraduate, study East Asia or Korea or the U.S.-Korea alliance at all. I did study U.S. foreign policy, but totally different region. Out of college, I taught U.S. history for a year. I went and I was a commodities trader for about 2 years at the Chicago Board of Trade, mostly soy and corn futures and some crude as well. So totally outside the academic and foreign policy arena. And decided I wanted to reconnect with things international. And I went and I taught English in South Korea with a sort of nebulous idea that I would pursue graduate studies, which I ended up starting in Korea. And then I decided to come back to the US full time to complete my master's. And at that point, I was focusing on Korea, on the region, on the US-South Korea alliance and the alliance with Japan as well. And from there, the master's led to the PhD. And many trips back and forth to the peninsula for intensive language training and field research. And after several stints in think tanks here in DC, a brief stint as a professor, and then several stints in think tanks, I found myself in my current position at the National Defense University in INSS, as you mentioned.
Fascinating. Where did you do language training? I did 18 months out at Sagang University. How about you?
I was at Yonsan. Yonsei is Hangugo Hakdang.
Actually, Yonsei is, I mean, I get in trouble saying this, I guess, but I think it's probably the premier language institution. All my Sogang colleagues will cast stones at me for saying that. But
they say each has its own sort of respective strength, some more conversational, some more grammar and composition. But yeah, I'll let you jump into the fighting between.
Well,
the
and then in actuality, I think Sagang had a greater conversational and Yonsei
right.
had greater
right.
grammar and process. No, I wholly agree with you. Well, you know, I mentioned the fact that you are prolific in writing in this space. In fact, you know, just recently you put out a three-piece series on this issue with a diplomat. I've read it all. I encourage you know, our audience to read it as well. It is a real good primer on understanding this security issue. I've lived this issue for decades now. I very much enjoyed reading this. Maybe we'll get into talking inside stuff when we're in here, but I you are the right person to sit down and have this discussion with. So I'm real grateful that we're getting together on this.
Likewise.
I think before we actually jump into this, though, you know, I mentioned at the outset that, you know, today in Washington, D.C. Was President Trump, President Lee's summit. And so maybe you could just give us an initial readout from that. What stood out to you?
Right. So, I mean, it was as all the reporting and coverage in the run-up to it framed it as a sort of pivotal or high-stakes meeting. And then just before it, some concern about President Trump's Truth Social post, something that President Lee himself in the hours afterwards sort of joked about when he was at CSIS. So I think there was some trepidation going in. But all things considered, I think it went rather well. They highlighted the areas of existing or future cooperation that you know, much of the pre-summit discussion presaged, you know, in shipbuilding and emerging technologies, obviously in traditional security areas. And in the Oval, spent a fair amount of time talking about the importance of engagement with North Korea and lowering the temperature and the alignment in both presidents, the importance of trying to engage North Korea and in the pursuit of not only a more stable peninsula, but you know, it potentially denuclearization of North Korea as lofty and distant a goal as that appears today. So I think all things considered that, and along with his visit, President Lee's visit, I should say, to Japan to meet Prime Minister Ishiba, I think a rather successful two summits and diplomatic swing for South Korea. And we'll continue tomorrow, as I understand, with President Lee going up to Philly to the Hanwha Philly shipyards, which is, you know, we're sort of a lodestar example of existing and potentially future shipbuilding cooperation between South Korea and the U.S.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So Saturday, I guess, with Prime Minister Ishiba, and that was, you know, the first bilateral, and that was as a first, right? I mean, the first time that South
right.
Korea is meeting with the Japanese Prime Minister before he has met with his U.S. With U.S. President counterpart. That was the first, and I think it maybe it presages things to come as well.
Right.
Yeah, and then the Philly Hanwha Philly shipyard. That'll be fascinating. It's you know, having been to South Korean shipyards, it's nowhere on the scale of those. And Philly Hanwha Philly, I think that merger last year occurred, and so there's a lot of growth and a lot of things that happen there. Fascinating overview on these things. I think thanks for sharing that with the group. Some of them will follow up and dig deeper on this, but I would concur with you. I watched the press brief, which is about 45 minutes, and that all in all was positive. And so
the one thing, if I might just quickly interject, the one thing I might add as well was in his remarks. I think it was in the Q&A afterwards with John Hamry. President Lee did mention that South Korea intended to increase its defense spending, which is not a new message from his administration, but may potentially be the first time he himself has expressed that as a way to help, as you said in your intro, modernize the alliance and take more of a lead, South Korea take more of a lead in an alliance context and in deterrence and defense on the peninsula. So that was, I think, something of note.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I want to take us into the discussion, and I want to kind of talk about this 2025, 2030 window. And this is really, I mean, the political stars have kind of aligned. President Trump and President Lee, I mean, they're both in power basically until the end of the decade. And so here's the question. Will wartime OPCOM be transferred before they leave office? And if so, what kind of alliance will emerge if that happens?
Right. So, you know, my first responsible analytic response is I'm not entirely sure, but I might reference an earlier historical example, which you know all too well because you were involved in the command relations study and whatnot that ultimately went into it as a way to help us think about the present day context. So if you would ask me the question, that same question in 2007, when the strategic transition plan was first established, which was sort of the first official plan to transition wartime operational control, eventually dissolve the CFC into two parallel but still interconnected commands. If you had asked me then, would they do it in the 5 years that they had set to do it, I would have said, well, maybe. That's what the goal has been set for April of 2012, I think it was. But we're also nearing the end of two administrations. We don't know the administrations that are going to come into office after them. At the time in South Korea, there was a groundswell of opposition to this policy from the conservative establishment. So presumably if they were to come to power, they would oppose it and potentially find a way to further kick the can down the road. And this is, of course, what ended up happening. Whereas where we are today under the conditions-based operational control transition plan, when it was first devised, it was said that, you know, it might occur sometime in the early to mid 2020s. Well, we've passed that. We're now in 2025. I remember when Biden came into office and there was about a year left in the Moon Jae-in administration, which was eagerly trying to push completion of the conditions-based plan or COTP before the end of its term. Reports really started to emerge once Biden was in office that this probably wasn't going to happen until about 2028. So here we are, we're still in that window where all sort of reporting and coverage of it could lead one to believe that based on the current conditions-based OPCON transition plan, the alliance may very well go through the different wickets they need to test that South Korea has acquired the right capabilities, that they can lead the combined defense, and that there is an assessment by both sides mutually together that the regional and peninsular conditions are conducive to a transfer. That could absolutely happen before the end of both terms. As you already alluded to, clearly the Lee Jae-myung administration it was in his campaign platform, the State Affairs Commission that has sort of set the broader framework for his administration's policy has said they'd like to achieve it within his term. The South Korean Minister of National Defense in his National Assembly remarks said he intended to see it done before 2030. The presidential office, the South Korean presidential office, walked his comments back after that. Anyway, the point is the political impetus is there. But the question is, you know, if it remains the current policy of a conditions-based approach, they have to meet the conditions they've mutually agreed to. I see no reason why they can't do that within 5 years. But then there's also the possibility, if the political impetus is strong enough, to revise those conditions, to rethink them so as to make it more expedient to complete it. The stars could potentially align for that. That's speculative at this point. But even under the current policy, the conditions-based policy, I think it's totally possible for the transition to happen before 2030.
Yeah, no, interesting. You know, when this began, so in 2003, when we began with the command relations study, you know, Moo Hyun has put this forward, and this is something that they, you know, campaign, they want to move forward on it. But the U.S. is less receptive to this. And so unless you've got both working in this direction, you can't make movement. And so then what causes, the same actors are in place and on the U.S. side, but what changes? And what changes is the war in Iraq, which begins in 2003, and it's going to continue, and it's going to go much longer. We need forces and things, and realize maybe they've got something here. Maybe if they take this over, we'll have less of a. And so then both sides are now thinking in a similar direction, which leads to this. And so when I talk about having the two sides thinking in the same direction, since the origins of this, that has mattered. And if you track it, and you have tracked this along, then you can find when progress is made or things happen, it's because both sides are in concurrence moving in that direction.
Right. They both have to be moving in the same direction. And just an added point, we might really get into this with further questions, but it's not just here. Neither side is a monolith in and of itself, right? There's the range of opinions within the different departments and agencies on both sides, some pushing forward, some more hesitant to do so. So there's internal bureaucratic contestation and sometimes quite stark infighting that will help set the course and either propel it or delay it and temper it.
Let's talk about this, you know, as transfer or transformation. I mean, OPCON transfer is often framed as a technical milestone. Even you kind of hinted to some of that in here, but it could signal the end of a U.S.-led command in Korea. So is this merely a shift in operational control, or is it a fundamental transformation of the alliance? Help us understand that a little bit.
I'm going to do the classic prevaricating academic answer and say it's both. And maybe try to elaborate.
Life
on
is
what
almost
I mean
like
that,
though.
It's either. Right. this is one of the things that makes it so interesting and frustrating. Is it's so complex. You have things that are true at the same time that are mutually conflicting, but no less true in and of themselves when it comes to this OPCON discussion. And it's really a broader alliance conversation. So on the one hand, it is just a transfer of operational control, which is in the broader history, which, as you alluded to, I get into in some of my recent pieces. This is really a continuation of a long-term trend where South Korea has gradually taken on much more of the burden relative to their larger U.S. ally in an alliance and combined alliance command architecture. So this would be really just the fruition of what's been a longer-term process and has been alliance policy for now two decades. It's been what we've moved towards as an alliance. It would be more fundamental, though, insofar as, again, referencing that same broad history, when you look at South Korea's existence as a nation state, as a juridical entity established in 1948, it's only possessed the operational control of its own military for 1 year of that national existence. And that was from June of 1949, when the last U.S. armed forces in Korea from the occupation period combat forces departed, to June of 1950, when the Korean War broke out. And very early in that war, President Lee Sigmund passed operational control and what he referred to as command authority, I think inaccurately, in his letter to General MacArthur, back to the U.S.-led United Nations command. So the one time when South Korea did possess operational control and full command of its own forces, and there's a difference between operational control and command, but the one time when they had that, they were nearly swallowed whole by external invasion and would have been had it not been for the return of U.S. forces and leadership in the combined architecture. So in that broader historical sweep, for them to take the lead role. And within, again, the current conditions-based transfer plan, which would maintain the CFC as it exists, it would be the future CFC, and a ROC four-star general would become the commander and a U.S. the deputy commander, that would be a fundamental shift, unlike, again, but for that 1 year, anything South Korea has had in its national existence, and also relative to its larger great power ally. So there's some discordance and historical sort of inverse there that I think is of fundamental import, especially when we think about the psychology around that. I'll stop there because I know we'll probably get into more of the details.
Well, you know, no, that's fascinating. As you were speaking, I was thinking about for several years during the Vietnam War, they also in combat exercise.
That's right.
Yeah. You can pull more on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's right. I should be so entirely sweeping. The South Koreans, that is, which actually most people aren't aware of, sent more forces than any other U.S. ally to the U.S. war in Vietnam.
Yeah, they had two divisions.
And actually, at a certain point, as the U.S. began to withdraw forces in the early 70s, South Korea had more forces per capita there than even the U.S. did. For a window, which is a sort of little known remarkable fact. But you're right to reference that when they had forces in South Korea, they did have operational control over their own forces, and that was in active combat. And that was that in Vietnam. And that actually was a critical experience in a more critical decade in the alliance, where there was a great deal of transformation in the command architecture, and the CFC itself was established. In part, and there were other factors, in part because of the advance that South Korea had made, not only in its defense modernization and capabilities, but in its operational and command and control acumen, born of the experience in Vietnam, and also quite a lot of fighting along the inter-Korean border during the so-called Second Korean War in the late 1960s.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. No, thanks for pulling on that a little bit further. And we'll actually hear a little bit later. I'll take us in and we'll talk about the Combined Forces Command that you just referenced. But before we do that, let's talk about this split focus or split alliance. I mean, the U.S. is increasingly prioritizing China, while South Korea remains centered on the North Korean threat. So are we dividing responsibilities, or are we drifting toward divergent strategic priorities? How do you see that?
Well, I mean, you know, James, that the alliance and the U.S. can chew gum and walk at the same time. So, you know, I know you're framing the question that way because this is the way it's being discussed and framed.
That's right. In
the public sphere. I would sort of push. I was going to say quibble, but I think it's a little bit stronger than that. I would push back against the overly dichotomous framing. That's premised in the question, not to put you on the spot for it, but this is how it's being framed and discussed, right? And I would say now certainly there are differences of how did you put it, strategic priorities or even threat perceptions on that level when it comes to China between Washington and Seoul. There's really no doubt about that. But I think when there's so much focus put on potential operations on the peninsula versus a regional contingency elsewhere, it's sort of one or the other and having to choose between them, I don't think that's an accurate way to even think about how, God forbid, there were a conflict in one place or the other, it would transpire. They're interconnected from the jump and well beforehand. And I think the alliance has to, based on each country's own narrower national interest, but certainly in alliance context, think about how those things are already interconnected. So it's not either or, it's this and that is probably a better way to think about it. However, to the degree that this does get framed in an overly bifurcated way, where so much emphasis is put on the potential crisis or crisis moment where there's a conflict, if that frames all of the discussion, it has the potential to enhance those differences in threat perception and strategic priority and politicize them. and I think lead to a hardening of positions and a more difficult conversation about where strategic priorities on and beyond the peninsula intersect. So I think it's important to, there's a lot of ink being spilled on this, and a lot of it is, everyone's trying to get their clicks, so they frame it in a way that draws attention. But I think it's unhelpful for the alliance and even for analysis to frame it so dichotomously.
Yeah, no, thanks for that thoughtful answer and response. And you're absolutely right. Those who follow these issues understand the dichotomous ways these are being spoken about. And I couldn't agree with you more. Life and things in it is typically not this or that, but somewhere on this continuum of both. And so
Right.
let's pull on the United Nations Command, right? And talk about this next chapter. I mean, the United Nations Command, the UNC, has underpinned deterrence since the Korean War. I guess it was on the screws 82, 3, and 4 were the ones that led towards the development of UNC. But its post-OPCON role, one can argue, remains a little bit uncertain. And so here's the question: could UNC serve as a critical multinational framework after OPCON transfers? And if so, how? What are your thoughts there?
Right. So the short answer is yes, it could. I would add yes, it should. And part of how is how it already works, how the mechanism already would operate. But you're right. It is an open question. And you mentioned the series of articles I'm writing. It's an ongoing series, and one of the articles, I think the final one actually, will look at exactly this question. So hopefully I can work through and make sense of some of the ideas I'll be
Yeah.
putting to paper. One of the reasons why it hasn't been too much of an issue that there are these different theater level commands is the same four-star U.S. commander has led all of them, right? USFK, CFC, and UNC, even though they all have different roles and responsibilities and chains of command. When this discordance, if you will, between the UNC and this longer transition process really first started to emerge in the early 90s with peacetime or armistice transfer of operational control back to South Korea. Because that means that, excuse me, at that point in time, because South Korea took over day-to-day security on the peninsula and essentially took the lead in response to an immediate crisis or North Korean provocation, whereas the US before had had OPCON from peacetime to wartime, there really was no division between those two states. It meant the UNC sort of relinquished, relatively speaking, a level of influence over a crisis environment. And as a result of that, as it has in various points in time asserted that role of maintaining the armistice and trying to bring crisis back down to armistice, it has caused successive South Korean administrations to sort of bristle at what they view as sort of sovereignty constraining moves by the UNC for its own self-defensive measures against North Korean provocations. This often arises under conservative administrations who take a more punitive or retaliatory approach to North Korean provocations. But we've seen also under progressive administrations, there's a reticence to lean too much into the UNC as well. I think there are various factors that go into this, but it can be viewed as a way, it can be viewed as an instrument that constrains inter-Korean relations. The sort of the scale and scope and speed at which inter-Korean cooperation can move, sort of literally on the ground in and around the DMZ, which the UNC has a distinct legal authority in overseeing. And so presumably, as operational control wartime OPCON transition moves forward and South Korea, again, under the current policy construct, takes a lead, each step as we move forward, there's no going back once you move forward these steps, right? It's just politically speaking, there's no going back once you move forward with the next transition. And with each of these transitions, we've seen that South Korea has become more empowered. It's taken a more robust role. It's pushed back more. And this is all understandable against sort of lineages of the residue or lineages of these institutions that have constrained some of their choices and behavior. And so what would have to happen of necessity in my mind to your question, South Korea would have to buy into the UNC still playing a role of marshaling multinational forces. And I'm not talking about just in a crisis or a potential conflict, because it's not technically a warfighting command, but for broader diplomatic purposes too, and signaling purposes. And I think if South Korea is naturally is going to take more of a lead in deterrence in the peninsula, they have to be more read into, lean more into, and have more acumen in welcoming multinational support to the peninsula. I think that just of necessity, they have to, I don't know if mature is the right word, because that sounds patronizing, and I don't mean it like that, but I just sort of leveling up in terms of their command and control. It goes beyond just the alliance. They have to adopt a broader aperture. And so I think it can and it should, the UNC, play this role, but a necessary condition for that is for South Korea to really embrace that. Now, I will say, under the previous, now disgraced, Yoon Suk-yeol administration, rightfully disgraced, I might add, President Yoon really did lean into embracing the UNC. That was something he did
more
do
than
that
any
was,
other president.
More than any other South Korean president. So I wrote several pieces at the time. I've been sort of tracking and looking to see that, and I was sort of taken aback by really how much. I think there were different motivations or rationales for why he might have been doing that, but whatever his intentions or rationales, the effect I thought was a good one. New members joined, existing members increased their fidelity to it. UNC member states were more involved in alliance exercises, and their collective signaling about a potentially renewed conflict on the Korean War. They sort of renewed or re-upped their earlier 1953 statement in a current context, all the UNC member states. So there's no reason why that can't continue. I haven't seen anything so far, please correct me if I'm wrong, from the Lee Jae-myung administration that would belie that trend so far. But there is always that potential, especially as South Korea takes a more robust role and a lead role, for them to push back against anything they view as constraining their leadership or sovereignty. And it also raises questions, the post-Hopcon transition UNC, about does the U.S. commander remain a three or four? Does he remain a four star, or maybe is the commander downgraded to a three star? It opens multiple cans of worms. I've been sort of meandering through it now, so I'll stop. Otherwise, I'll just keep going.
I'm going to pull you a little bit later, but I'll just kind of highlight that I'm going to do that when we talk a little bit. I want to talk about this one theater concept in a little bit. And I think that there are people that are thinking a future use for UNC then. So we can pull on that when we get to that part. But it is, UNC is, we could do an entire episode just on that, because it is, the efforts on revitalization that have gone on, whether General Sharp was doing things or Scaparotti or Brooks after him, and on and on and on, and how this is been evolving. It's just a fascinating look at this unified command, and with that brought about this change is the Combined Forces Command, right? And so I want to talk a little bit about the fate of that. But the Combined Forces Command, I mean, its formation in 1978, and how that alters UNC's mission after that, from being a warfighting command to just an armistice enforcement command. But as you, and you can pull on this deeper in your response, but as we think about CFC, can it survive a parallel command structure? I alluded to that a little bit in the beginning. You can pull on that. You know exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about parallel command structure. Can it survive that, or is it a dissolution that would be already underway? Pull on that, and I know you have the expertise to get after what I'm asking.
Well, yeah. So if, again, the current policy, the conditions-based OPCON transition plan, COTP, I don't want to use too many acronyms here. I still can't make sense of all of them. But the conditions-based policy does not entail dissolving CFC.
It
explicitly entails maintaining the Combined Forces Command, the future Combined Forces Command. There are a lot of details to this.
Parallel command was the original
right,
intent.
Right. Right. So initially in 2007, when wartime OPCON transition became a mutually agreed upon alliance policy toward which the alliance was moving, it was under what would have been a parallel command construct, which explicitly involved the dissolution and dissolving of the CFC. CFC no longer would have existed. There would have been no unity of command in the traditional military sense of the word. There would have been no one strategic commander. There would have been two independent parallel national commands, the ROC Joint Chiefs of Staff, ROC JCS, and USFK would have been evolved into what they were calling US Korea Command or CORCOM. Now, there were combined elements that would have been maintained within this parallel structure, and all parallel structures, to the extent that they've existed historically, have, it's a matter of degree. There are levels of synchronization in different parallel structures. Under the STP, the Strategic Transition Plan, and even the next plan, there were combined elements. So still combined air, amphibious, counter WMD operations, and those combined elements would have remained under the operational control of a US GOFO, General Officer, Flag Officer. So even within this ostensibly parallel construct, there still would have been these combined elements, some of which the US would have maintained operational control under because of the capabilities that the US brought to bear that, that South Korea just didn't. There also would have been maintained the military committee structure, providing strategic level guidance as it has under the CFC for its entire existence, as well as sort of an office, a combined bilateral alliance coordination office that would have helped on the operational and tactical level. So they still provide a lot of combined elements to the parallel construct, but the CFC would have been dissolved. Like I said, South Korea would have been taking the lead and been the supported command, and the US CORCOM would have been the supporting command. They scrapped all that. They went back to maintain the CFC and future CFC moving forward. So, you know, if the Lee Jae-myung administration and the Trump administration, they have not said they're doing this, I've written about it speculatively as a possibility. If they decided to return to a parallel construct for reasons that go beyond the peninsula involving, you know, strategic flexibility as a concept, that would, again, potentially involve dissolving the CFC. If you're going to a parallel construct, again, by definition, that means you don't have one strategic commander and unity of command. This is one of the problematic elements of a parallel construct, is you forego unity of command, which can create problems, especially in a crisis or conflict. But you know, we're not. Its dissolution is not already underway. So I would not say that. My understanding is, though, that when there was that previous plan to go towards a parallel construct, even when they shifted back to a combined command construct to maintain the CFC, and Sean Kramer has written in detail about this, so really the best stuff in the English language that you can get. So I recommend it to all your viewers.
Yeah, he just recently put out a piece with Butler that was really good.
Right, he did, the UNC bit, right? And another one as well, updating the C2 stuff. Prolific writing. In fact, he's probably my best teacher, just reading all his stuff. He highlights in one of his papers, the title of which escapes me at the moment, that even after they shifted from parallel back to combined, the process that was empowering the ROC JCS and USFK, which would have become CORCOM, never did, that process kind of continued or was never sort of put back towards the CFC. So they're still sort of de facto in practice developed a sort of parallel mindset, even within a combined structure. So I don't know, but I would tend to think that some of the efforts in recent years, not just towards moving towards assessing and certifying ROC capabilities towards OPCON transfer, but a lot of alliance efforts have been moved towards like just building back some of that combinedness and that combined thinking and operating. So again, that's getting really into the weeds, but that's what comes to mind when you ask that. Even within the takeaway being that even within the current combined structure, there are still elements and mindsets that might have retained a sort of parallel thrust and trajectory to them.
You know, when I think about this, and I'll just pull just a little bit more, but so obviously the reason or reasons for the original construct of parallel commands was the U.S. doesn't have a history of putting its forces under the command of another officer. There's thoughts about the capabilities of the Koreans and to be able to do the thing, and so maybe they should do the thing on their own and do it in parallel. The even down in Camp Humphreys today, when they were at Yongsan, they were in the same building working together, and now they're in different buildings, right? The Koreans are in their building,
Co-location, foregoing co-location,
and so all of these leads, and then to the point you also made mention of, if they're doing different things, and this is early days to say, but if the Koreans are focused more on the North Korean threat, and the U.S. is focused more on China threat, all of these things lead to asking questions about what does a future CFC look like, and hence do an entire dialogue on that. There is a lot there, and I know I've given you so much that are really, there's so much to depth in all of these, but that's kind of the thinking on. Let's go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead. No, go ahead, Clint.
I'll try to make this short, which I'm not apt to do. But you just raised the point of at a certain point, there's capabilities acquisition, there's exercises and training to demonstrate you can do this stuff. But at the end of the day, you just got to do it to be able to do it. Right? There's at a certain point, again, this will sound patronizing, it's just a metaphor. Like the bird has to leave the nest, it has to fly, right? And it only learns to do that by doing the thing. And I've had conversations with folks, interesting counterfactuals about like what would the alliance look like today had we actually moved forward with the STP and transitioned wartime OpCon in April of 2012. It's tough to say. You could literally thread antithetical trajectories, which is what makes this analytically maddening, but also interesting. But I think at a certain point, there are conditions they have to meet, the South Koreans have to meet, and the alliance has to meet. Sometimes there's a, I mean, having conversations with some of our previous four stars, they said that one of the psychological hurdles that they experienced, and this may be a little dated, we may be moving past this, and that would be a good thing, but maybe not, is that the ROK officers are constantly judging themselves by the metric of US command and control, strategic and operational capabilities. And that's the highest level of grade you can hold yourself to. And it's sort of an unfair expectation and standard to hold yourself to, one which, sort of cynically speaking, if you set that up, you're never going to meet it,
That's right.
right? Which means you're never going to transfer, which means you can
That's
kick it down the road. And so, somehow the alliance is going to have to square that psychology, and there's psychology on the US side too.
There is.
This is the control rod that I talked about in the first two pieces,
Yeah,
where
that was a good piece.
you right you gotta assess and certify the criteria, the conditions. That's critical. That's brass tacks stuff. You got to make sure they can, the alliance as a whole can do the things that meet the conditions you've set out to meet. But then there's like an area of give where you just gotta say, okay, there's a risk involved in this regardless, and we have to accept that there may be certain benefits that come on the other side of it, and we only get to those by taking that risk, but navigating it as an alliance. If you think about it as OpCon transition means the end of the alliance, it's all over, then it's more questionable and scary, and there's pushback, especially in Korea. But that's not what we're talking about. That's not as though we transition and the US is gone. We're still there. There's still an alliance. So we can work through that risky growing pains period. And I've promoted the idea of sort of a rotational lead as we move towards combat, transition. Like command and deputy commander switch back and forth for a certain period of time. Where the South Koreans build their chops, sort of running it, and go back to deputy, and then in sort of iterated fashion, and that's how you build towards the transition. I'll stop there. That was 3 minutes. I timed myself.
No,
that
no.
wasn't
I'll
too
tell
bad.
you a thousand things I want to say. What you just, but I'll constrain myself. Let me move us down a little bit further, and talk about this deterrence or departure. And when we're talking about deterrence, skepticism is growing in South Korea about the credibility of U.S. extended deterrence. And so, question: could Hakan transfer intensify calls for an indigenous nuclear option, which frankly were, as you know, particularly in the last administration, I mean, it was off the chart, the degree of
Right.
discussion that was going on about that.
So on a certain level, my response is yes, absolutely. For two reasons. One, they're taking more of a lead. It's only natural. If we're taking a lead in deterrence, the ultimate deterrence is our own indigenous nuclear weapons program. It's sort of like you spin the logic forward to that is the ultimate deterrent. If we're taking the lead, we should have that. Sort of simplistic but compelling logic, if you will. The other reason is, and some of this is predicated on how OPCON transition occurs. What's the state of the alliance? What's the level of trust in the alliance? What is the alliance signal that's looking like on the other side of OPCON transition? What is the combined, what is the command architecture going to look like? Does it remain combined? Is it parallel? Is the US going to, after OPCON transition, withdraw and reduce and really make very flexible its forces? So how it moves forward, it's going, again, depending on how it moves forward, there will be concern in South Korea that it's portending abandonment. We've seen this narrative emerge time and again, almost exclusively from the conservative camp. And I have no doubt, I mean, that first of all, that narrative exists today, so it's not as though it's going to emerge again, but it would be amplified, I think, by OPCON transition. But again, different types of processes by how we got to transition would, I think, have a not insignificant effect on how amplified and how salient that narrative would be. The other argument, maybe counter to that might temper that is under the current E.J. Myung administration, I would actually commend the president, including in his CSIS address just a few hours ago, where he has very explicitly talked about the importance of maintaining the non-proliferation regime on the Korean Peninsula. And clearly he's talking about in the two Koreas, inter-Korean context, but this goes to South Korea as well. So I think that's an important message. And with OPCON transition, again, it stands to reason that the more South Korea takes on a more lead role, better understanding and making interoperable where South Korea capabilities end and US capabilities begin, especially strategic ones, is really critical. So it may actually lead to a further deepening of extended cooperation around extended deterrence, which could itself temper demands for their own indigenous nuclear weapons, so that you could see
Right.
countervailing pressures.
For those less, of course, you understand this, but not all of our audience will, that South Korea was the first of the two Koreas to develop a nuclear weapons program, and they did that in the 70s. And so this is not a just a they never created nuclear weapons, but they were, Park Chung-hee had moving along those lines, and there were
Right.
security reasons for it. But the So it's not all academic, the thought of them moving in such a direction. They actually have a real history of having done that, and the conditions continue to press on countries as they're making such decisions.
Right.
I want to take us and I want to take us a little bit further. I mentioned about this one theater, one vision. Japan has been moving rapidly towards integrated command with the U.S. supported by Australia and the Philippines, particularly. On this, one theater vision. And so, as others align under a one theater vision, how can Korea avoid, strategic marginalization? Because there is a real risk there, I think.
Right. I would maybe slightly push back against the premise that the US-Japan alliance is rapidly moving towards integrated
Rapidly
command,
might be.
right? That said, though, to your point, they clearly are moving towards more integrated arrangement, and there have been notable developments in the last few years. So historic, really, in a broader alliance context. I still do have questions and some skepticism about the degree to which I think there are concerns in Japan about to what degree will this lead to us maybe ceding a certain degree of authority to the US and then ourselves being entangled in operational situations that we would like to have more autonomy or flexibility to determine our involvement in. I think there's more of that in Japan than folks in DC might properly appreciate. But your point is well taken. The Japanese defense minister has been explicitly introduced this one theater concept when Secretary of Defense Hegseth was there. And also to the point of the question, one editorial after another and commentary after another in Seoul after those comments was quite opposed to this idea. I think in part because it was voiced by a Japanese defense minister, but also the idea itself. So how does South Korea avoid marginalization? Well, one part of it is what we've been discussing, which is taking more of a role on the peninsula. The other part of it is something I don't know how well I articulated it at the start of our conversation, but it involves leaning more into doing more, not just on but beyond the peninsula, and the idea that the US has multiple responsibilities. But this doesn't have to be framed just like it's often framed in terms of you handle a crisis or a conflict in Korea, and then the Taiwan uber alles we deal with elsewhere, and we have to be able to use our forces as we so choose. Again, that's a hypothetical situation. I'm not saying it couldn't happen or it's not probable, but we shouldn't let a hypothetical crisis necessarily determine how we think about and cooperate on sort of modernizing the alliance. And so I think there are a lot of ways. I mean, the South Korean government is grappling with the PRC's increasing coercive encroachment in the Yellow Sea, or what Koreans call the West Sea. And to my mind, the PRC is following the same playbook they've followed in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea. And it's something that the South Korean people, sentiments among South Koreans towards China have clearly turned negative for a not small sample size number of years now. That doesn't necessarily mean they view China as a threat, but the sentiment is increasingly negative, and there's an increasing awareness that South Korea is, in the event of crisis or conflict elsewhere, that it's there's a degree of unavoidability to South Korea's involvement. In some ways, I think the South Korean people's awareness of this, and I don't want to say embrace of it, but awareness of it and understanding that they're involved in one way or another, may even be further ahead of their own elites, their own policy elites. And there's still sort of early polling on this, but I think there more and more polling is going to be done. So I think the strategic conditions around the peninsula, right, there's a lot between Taiwan and the peninsula. There's a lot of space there, and it's not like it's a vacuum where nothing happens. And a lot of it bears directly on South Korea's interests, and it goes beyond just North Korea's activities. So I think there's a lot of space that can be filled in there. That South Korea's experiencing pressures and an impetus to start to think and plan for. And I, at least from sort of younger defense analysts who I try to keep a beat on their writing, they're grappling with this openly and writing openly about it in ways that you wouldn't have seen 5, 7 years ago. So that's so the Overton window, so to speak, is kind of shifting on it.
No, you're right. Ask this last question. So as we design this new alliance, the old model, which I've, for some time have been writing about this US-led peninsula-focused single threat force. I mean, it's starting to appear that that's no longer sufficient. And as the threat is so much greater, right, than just what's been on the peninsula. And so here's a question: what must the ROK and the US preserve, adapt, and then build to ensure that the alliance endures and evolves?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I feel I've been touching on this. But I think, one, and there could be misalignment within this cooperative effort, but one area where South Korea has really been moving forward is in assisting with regional sustainment and logistics, and or at least signaling they want to assist in, and usually framed as cooperation and maintenance, repair, and overhaul MRO. And when you look at DoD's regional sustainment framework, which came out in the spring of 2024, but to my reading has been something that's been really, there's been a fair amount of continuity and consistency from the Biden to the Trump administration with this, I think deservedly so, because it's really brass tack stuff. The South Koreans have been sort of eagerly signaling their desire to be involved in supporting MRO on the peninsula, which has clearly regional implications. And South Korea brings incredible national capacities to that picture. I would argue South Korea brings more national capacities to that picture than any other U.S. ally in the world. I, you know, it's, it, I think I've said that enough where and people's eyebrows raise when I say that, but
No,
I
I think
actually
you're right.
I have no doubt. I need
I've
to write
traveled
that paper,
throughout
right?
to many of
I mean, I'm
industries and seen
talking
firsthand what you're talking
everyone.
about.
UK, Germany, Japan, doesn't matter. They don't hold a candle to, I mean, the South Koreans provided more 155 artillery to Ukraine than all of Europe combined. Full stop. Right? It was circuitous. They didn't announce it, but they did it. The point being, that's an area where they're cooperating a lot. I do wonder if the South Koreans view it in a more political economy and profit-based motive, and not as firmly aware of the strategic potential regional crisis aspect of it, which the U.S. regional sustainment framework lays out quite clearly, prevailing in a contested logistics environment. So there could be some friction there. But that's an area that's cooperation now in peacetime. And it has defense industrial cooperative elements to it. It has economics elements, it's sort of shared prosperity, and it's preparedness. It doesn't, it's not overly militaristic. There are a lot of dual purpose, civilian purpose uses to a lot of that activity. So I think that's an area where they're already doing it, and they can and should build on it. And that sort of builds that connectivity between peninsula and beyond.
Let me ask you just a couple questions. The audience, we'll go quick. This will be lightning round because
Lightning round.
we're pressing time.
That's my fault.
No. We've had so much to get over. It's an amazing conversation. I've greatly enjoyed it. External pressures. How might Russia and North Korea coordinate their responses to an evolving Rocky-U.S. alliance, and what pressures could they create for Seoul and Washington?
Well, I think they're already creating pressures. I mean, it's
They are.
I would, my short answer is reference your wonderful conversation with Rachel Min-Young Lee, because you talk about it, so it's great. That's the, this is lightning round. That's my short answer. But
Okay, good.
right, listen to that conversation.
Rachel and I had a good discussion on that.
I'll just
Please
do a
follow up
poor
on that. I
rendition
agree.
of it. So yeah, just listen to what Rachel has to say, and you as well.
Demographic reality. So with South Korea and Japan both facing
Yeah.
severe aging population challenges, that was even brought up in their summits, how might demographic realities reshape long-term defense readiness and trilateral cooperation with the U.S.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, we're already seeing it. I mean, the manpower numbers are decreasing before our eyes, and that trend's not only going to continue, but it's going to increase in pace. This is happening. Nothing short of a miracle will change it, and that miracle ain't coming. This is going to happen. It's a demographic cliff. Both Japan and South Korea face it. One short answer, just in terms of their own defense measures, is, and they're already talking about this, is autonomous systems, unmanned systems, it more advanced joint command architecture and sensors and things that sort of can see the environment more holistically, and layer systems, drone swarm type technology, things where you literally don't have the personnel to man the defenses and to respond in some ways that you once had. So you need to build your magazine depth with this sort of attritable emerging technology that is, quite frankly, really cheap to build. And you can build in mass, and they're starting to move in this direction. So that's one way to do it. At the end of the day, there I think there's when we talk about there has to be a political solution, and actual presence and boots on the ground is critical to that. You fuse these technologies with existing manpower, but this is the direction they're both going. And, I would expect them to have to continue going that way, because again, the demographic cliff is here and they're both falling off of it. I didn't really answer how that affects, but yeah, the trilateral, well, there are defense industrial tie-ups between U.S. firms and Japanese and Korean firms, because they bring comparative advantages to the different firms to these types of technology. So it's actually a new area where they can be working together. And it's also, there's a lot of technology here that doesn't just have military purposes. And in fact, it shouldn't be overly militaristic. We should really highlight the civilian applications of a lot of this stuff. A lot of this stuff can help with climate issues, with disaster response, humanitarian response. I think these are the issues where we're most likely to be cooperating. And so I think that's an area where there are potentially a lot of new ways that they can cooperate in the defense and industrial space in a trilateral context.
That's fantastic. This is an amazing time to be engaged in this security issues. And I think we are going to see tremendous change as we go forward, and I'm excited to be joined with colleagues like you looking at this. And thank you for your time today. Before I let you go, I'd like to ask guests to give a book recommendation to the audience. Maybe you might have one for us.
I do. I was using it to support this computer. I have actually two. One is Cornerstone of the Nation. The defense industry and the building of modern Korea under Park Chung-hee. So it talks a bit, about the Yongguk initiative in the 1970s, the secret nuclear weapons program that the aforementioned. And this is written by a friend of mine, Peter Bansuk Kwon. Really solid book. As we hear about South Korea really advancing its defense exports, this is the historical origins of it. And the other is something I've been reading again lately, but I would recommend it. It's Fearing the Worst: How Korea Transformed the Cold War, written by Samuel F. Wells Jr., I think for the Wilson Center of International Scholars, rest in peace. Also a wonderful book that puts the Korean War and the US commitment to Korea in a broader early Cold War context, which is really critical for people to understand. It highlights just how important Korea is as a catalyst to many bigger picture issues, and it continues to be. And I just don't think it gets enough attention, but I'm biased, so.
Those are wonderful recommendations. We'll put that in the show notes. Clint, thanks for being here with us this hour. We have learned so much from your experience in this. So thank you.
Thank you for having me, James.
As we conclude today's dialogue, we've seen that the ROC-US alliance is evolving from OPCON transfer to strategic flexibility. These changes will define deterrence on the peninsula and resilience across the Indo-Pacific. As we've heard today, this is not the end of an old model, but the design of a new one. These conversations shape security. On behalf of all of us at DKIA PCSS, thank you for being part of this important dialogue. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha boy. As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKIA PCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.